Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Yang kinci samudaya dhammang sabbantang nirodha dhammante. So we've just recited the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Buddha's first sermon. And this was traditionally held to have been given by the Buddha in the deer park in Isipatana to the group of five ascetics. And according to the Theravadan tradition, that happened on the Sala Puja, which was just the full moon last week. So because we'll be using this sutta as a basis for chanting for the next few months, it's probably appropriate to give a talk around this theme of the Four Noble Truths, and in some way to set the theme for the rains retreat. We use the number four, especially in ancient texts like the suttas. Then these numbers, they have a significance. They're not merely kind of dry and bland like numbers have become today. But in the Buddha's time, in the ancient world, numbers were always very significant because they connected one to the cosmos, to the stars, and also to the resonances and relationships that exist within things in this world. And in particular, historians say that the two main sources of development of numbers and number theory were astronomy and music. And in music, of course, you have like the sequence of overtones and song, which determines the development of harmony, like how different notes fit inside one another. And they do that with these kind of tantalizingly symmetrical numbers, which are kind of almost, but not quite, are perfect. That you have these like nested sets of fractions and proportions which all kind of interlock and make it possible for us to make music. And so these are felt to be like a kind of immanent pattern which also can explain how the world fits together with these like interlocking dynamics, these energies, these movements or principles or whatever they may be. Of course, in the Vedic period or Brahmanical period, then this often became expressed in terms of like the layout of shrines and so on. Then one had to lay the shrine in exactly the right way with the right proportions in the right direction so as to correspond with the cosmos and the movement of the stars and the sun and the moon and so on. Everything had to fit together. And so by making this little microcosm, then you were able to mirror what was going on in the heavens. And so this is why we use the word like a temple. The word temple is like a template, actually from the same root. So if we make a template of something, it means we make like a plan. We draw out a small-scale version of it. So to make a template, the temple is like a template for the cosmos. It fits in with the same proportions, the same sense of balance. And so this is how people in the ancient world would bring a sense of order to a chaotic world. Of course, when the Buddha came to formulate his Dhamma, he didn't accept a lot of the assumptions of the religions that were around him. So, for example, one of the ideas which was common in the religions around was the idea of the Purusha. The Purusha is like a cosmic man. And so it was felt that the universe was laid out on a divine plan which mirrored the shape of a human being. And so the whole cosmos could be mapped onto the shape of a human being with all the organs and proportions and things like that. And so, of course, that's a very, you know, way of putting, a very literal way of putting humanity, human lives, at the center of things. But that way of talking about or dealing with things, it wasn't open to the Buddha. He didn't want to invite or suggest some kind of animist or very kind of literalist assumptions about these things. He didn't want his followers to start speculating about these kinds of like cosmic correspondences and so on and so forth, which we find is one of the major preoccupations of the Upanishads. So instead, the Buddha wanted to find some way of like making a map or making an order for the Dhamma that would have a sense of harmony and balance. And so to do this, he used these interlocking sets of numbers without giving the numbers a specific referent. In this case, in other places they do, But in this case, they're not tied down in any concrete form to anything that we can observe in the world. Nevertheless, we can appreciate that, for example, using the number four for the Four Noble Truths. The number four is most commonly used to express the four directions, north, south, east, and west. And so the number four tends to have a connotation of being of comprehensiveness, of being all around. And of course, because four is also two times two, then also it has a sense of balance, can be divided up in any way. And so there's like a sense of perfect balance and perfect harmony about the number four and comprehensiveness. So when we look at the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, you see these kind of interlocking sets, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and the eight being like an intensification of the four, like the four directions plus the four intermediate directions. It's like an intensified form of that. And then, of course, one has the 12, the three rounds of the Four Noble Truths totaling 12. So then 12 being like another intensification of that perfection of the number four. And so one can also see this principle at work with the two extremes. And those two extremes is quite an interesting usage, because you have the Buddha presents these two extremes and then says, not going anywhere near these two extremes. I teach the Eightfold Path. Because the Eightfold Path is like something else. You've got one and you've got two and then you've got something else. And so that middle path is not the three in a sense. Obviously you could count it as a third, but it's not like a normal third. It's not like just one, two, and then you've got two options, and then you've got a third option. But it's something which is like a different kind of thing. It doesn't participate in the same principles. So this idea of that mysterious third, that mysterious other, is very important in Buddhism and recurs a number of times. We have the idea of, like, when we're looking at the world, we look at the gratification, the danger, and the escape. That's very similar to these two ways of practice. The first way of practice through indulgence, through seeking gratification, through seeking pleasure, through eating the ice cream of the world, through eating the marshmallows of the world. So what happens if you just eat ice cream all the time? And of course you get sick, you'd even die, wouldn't you? If you think about it, very simple. What happened if all you did was eat ice cream? And you'd die very quickly. And the other extreme is like the self-mortification. And so that's where you can see, I think, you know, one of the most obvious examples in modern society is people with anorexia and similar kind of eating disorders, where they're sort of starving and torturing their body. It's a kind of mental illness. So of course these things are extremes. And the middle way is like something else. So don't think of the middle way as being like an average way. The middle way isn't that we'll take a bit of self-indulgence and then a bit of torture and then you'll be right. This is the way of the world. Have ice cream on one day and then lettuce on the next 6 days of the week. Ice cream one day of the week and then lettuce for 6 days of the week, and then you think that's the middle way. This is not the middle way. The middle way is something else completely. So if we follow the way of indulgence, then we eat just what we want to, just for the taste of it. If we follow the way of deprivation, we eat or don't eat in order to starve or torment our body. If we follow the middle way, we eat in order to practice the Dhamma and realize the truth. It's an entirely different motivation. So that's that different slant on things, that different perspective is what the middle way is talking about. Sometimes it might not even change what you do outwardly. Maybe you just keep eating exactly the same way as you were before. I'm just using the eating as just an example here, because it's a fairly obvious example. So maybe you just keep eating this the way you had before. Maybe you're not going to change anything outside. Maybe you are. In some cases you will change yourself externally, but sometimes you might not. But you'll change your attitude towards it. Ajahn Dasara used to say that there were two, when it comes to food, that there were two kinds of defilements. One was people who like to eat a lot of food and indulge in having a lot, and then another one is the views about food. People have lots of views and ideas about food. And so that's also a bit like these two extremes, isn't it? The ones who like to eat a lot, then this is of like the indulgence in the food, and then the other one having lots of views about tends towards self-mortification, tends towards tormenting yourself, and especially usually towards tormenting others with your views about food. So again, the middle way has nothing to do with that. The middle way is you eat food to sustain your body for your spiritual practice. And so there's this like other, this third. So in this way, in this, when the Buddha was teaching this sutta using these numerical sets, he was like mapping out, he was like making this pattern. And then in later days and all through the rest of his years of teaching, he was like filling in the details of this pattern, like join the dots. But the basic shape of it stayed the same right from the beginning right through to the end. And so the Buddha's very last words, Vaya dhamma sankhara apamadena sampadeta, all conditions, all things of the world are subject or have the nature to disintegrate. Things fall apart. Strive on with diligence. Or you can either translate it as conditioned things are subject or have the nature of decay. Strive on with diligence. It's like the formal translation. Or you could say, stuff falls apart, just do it, which is a colloquial translation. Of course, that line was very famously quoted by Monty Python in the song In the Life of Brian, things just fall apart in every way. So it's that same message that the Buddha was giving, right from the first time that he taught, right up until the end. One of the key factors, the key distinguishing factors of this Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta is that it's based on the Buddha's own experience. And this is something he's emphasizing again and again and again. Pubbe ananusutesu dhammesu. Regarding dhammas that I've not learnt before from another. Anusutta means I've learnt from somebody else. So this is a dhamma which is not learnt from somebody else. A dhamma which was not learnt from a book. It's a dhamma which was not learnt from the Buddha's earlier teachers. It's a dhamma which was not picked up from the culture and ideas that were around at the time. So for this reason, the Buddhist traditions have always been, considered that these Four Noble Truths are those teachings or those dhammas which are characteristic of Buddhism, which are not found in other religion. Of course, we may find very similar things, but in terms of the exact way that they're formulated and taught, then it's quite, and the clarity and the centrality, the uncloudedness of the way that these teachings are presented, I think is quite unique to Buddhism. Certainly I haven't come across them in other religions, even though I've come across very similar ideas. But I've never come across another religion which puts it so clearly and plainly and places it in the center like Buddhism does. So these dhammas which were not learnt before from another, the Buddha teaches from his experience, the first extreme of self-indulgence. Of course, this is what Siddhartha Gautama had experienced when he was in the palace. One palace for the summer, one for the rainy season, one for the winter. All of his cloth he got from Benares. He had very special rice, special curries. Even the servants in his father's house were given luxurious food. The Buddha born, of course, into one of the ruling clans in the Sakyan Republic. Not as a prince or a king, as we would know, but as one of the sons of the aristocracy, his beautiful wife. And in those days, it was considered fairly normal that, obviously, if you're born as a man, then that's because you've got lots of merit. And so because you've got so much merit, then you didn't have to restrict yourself to just one woman. And so the ruling families and so on, as well as a wife, he would have had many concubines and lovers and so on. Kings had their harems and so on. So he went down that road as far as he could. I guess by today's standards, the luxuries and the pleasures of the palace seem a bit, you know, quite quaint. But really, when you look at it, it hasn't changed all that much, has it? You know, we really don't do too much that's different. Maybe we don't have dancing girls in our lounge room, but we've got MTV. So you watch the same thing, isn't it? Maybe you don't have a summer palace and a winter palace, but you've got an air conditioning unit, so you can just, in the summertime, you make it cool, and in the wintertime, you make it warm. And so he says our lifestyle is not too much removed because of the tremendous increase in material prosperity. Our lifestyle in Western countries is not too much removed from that of Prince Siddhartha's, even as an aristocracy. And many things, of course, we have that he would never have dreamed of. after a while, of course, getting sick of it and then going forth and practicing that extreme of self-mortification. And as we know, the Buddha gave his whole life into that. He almost killed himself. He was right on that verge, right on that edge where he would have died if he hadn't stopped fasting and torturing himself. That's how much dedication and sincerity that he had. He didn't care anymore. He was just going to give everything, but it just didn't work. Didn't have any benefits. Dukkho anariyo anatta sanhito. Painful, ignoble, and pointless. Not leading to the goal. So of course the Buddha, as the master psychologist, when he gave these teachings, because he was teaching to the five ascetics, when he presented the two extremes, he started out presenting the stream of indulgence, because he knew that as good ascetics that they'd agree with him. So he got them on side. First of all, tell them the bit that they'd all agree with, and then they go, yeah, yeah, right on. And then you hit them with the one that they're not going to agree with, and they stop them. Oh, hang on, what's going on? And so the Eightfold Path is something which doesn't have anything to do with these two extremes. Anupagamma, not going near the two extremes. And again, because the Buddha was concerned to present his Dhamma in a way that was entirely, I hesitate to use the word rational, entirely, I guess just sensible, entirely free of assumptions and unverifiable belief systems. So, just these things, right view, well, that makes sense, doesn't it? You have a right view about things, you know, you want to check things out, you want to have the correct opinion about them. And before we start our way along the path, then we're going to have to spend some time working on this. We're going to have to spend some time checking what are our opinions, what are our views. And this is something that's always been significant to me, always been important. Talking the other day about how I was brought up as a Catholic, and as I grew up, I started to more and more question these Catholic ideas, the ideas of God and so on, and I tried to investigate or reflect on them as well as I could. And the more I did so, the more I just found them really inadequate, even though it's quite difficult, it's quite painful to give up those views, but somehow I just couldn't do it anymore. I just couldn't make myself believe these things. But what was probably more significant was that I cared about it. I actually cared about whether God exists or not. As of course most people seem to drift along in their lives and they don't even really care about it very much. Or on some level they care about it, but they don't actually care enough about it to investigate it. And so there were two things that I always knew at that time. One was that I just couldn't understand how people could say they believed in God and then not act in a godly way. How people can say they believe in God and then, you know, as is happening in the world right as we speak, be sending bombers into Lebanon, Palestine, blowing people up, killing innocent lives, and then the more retaliations back again. Really, if you believe, then you're going to go to hell for killing for an infinite time. How could you do these things? Of course, they don't believe that, do they? They think they're going to go to heaven. That's an even worse kind of view. So, I always thought it was very important, and I always thought that if I found a religion or a way of life that was really true, then I'd have to give my life to it. I couldn't not give my life to it. And the second thing that I knew at that time was that since I was born and brought up as a Christian in a largely Christian culture, I knew somehow intuitively, I knew that my mind would be influenced by Christian ideas on a very deep level. And if I really thought that those ideas were wrong, were based on incorrect premises, like say that God exists, then surely there's going to be all kinds of ways in which my mind is going to be twisted and distorted. And so it was quite important to me to try to clarify my ideas and my thinking and so on, and try to understand how these things influenced me in ways that were obvious or subtle. And I'm still doing that. I'm still finding out ways that my own Christian background is influencing me. So this is all part of what we mean when we're talking about developing right view. And so, you know, right view, we have to remember, has like a content. It's not just a kind of a vague or, you know, wishy-washy term, but it has a certain content that's fairly specific. That doesn't mean that we can nail it down with a creed. And of course, this was one of the great errors that was made in Christian history, was to think that you could sum up, you know, your teaching or your beliefs with like a creed. So right view is not like that. But it does mean that you need to make an effort to correct your views and examine them, hold them up for inspection, and when they're wrong, when they're inadequate, then to kind of start to abandon them. This is something, of course, you know, you make the assumption that as long as we're not enlightened, then all of our views probably have something right and something wrong about them. That's a fairly reasonable assumption to make when we start doing this process. Nothing's completely wrong, but then it's probably not completely right either. And so the more we investigate, the more we question them, then the less we find that we're, you know, hung up on our own particular views, that we think that, you know, because I believe it, therefore it must be right. The more we investigate it, the more we realize, actually, these things are just conditions, just causes and conditions. You investigate it, change it. The world doesn't end because you let go of a belief. And so we all have a lot of this to do, especially even our Buddhist beliefs. And as you know, in this monastery, we don't just accept that the particular teaching or dogma that's been handed down by a particular tradition is true because the tradition says it's true. I can't make myself believe that. Just as when I was a Catholic, I couldn't make myself believe in God. So I don't have any choice about that. And so, again, we take the attitude trying to make a careful and critical inquiry, which is, of course, very different from merely a cynical dismissal of traditions. That's something that's completely different. But an inquiry into tradition to learn what we can learn from it, to try to find out what it means, what it meant to those people. If they did, the traditions did go astray at some points, then why did they do that? They were just human beings like you and I, so we're not more intelligent than they were, we're not more learned, we're not more, have better understanding of Dhamma than they did necessarily. So why did they develop certain beliefs and ways of looking at things? And so this, when we take that kind of attitude, we can always learn. And this is, when we do this, we start to realize actually there's usually quite a number of different perspectives and ways of looking at things. And by experimenting, trying to look at things in different ways, you get like a deeper kind of wisdom, a more compassionate wisdom, rather than having a very fixed view, it's like this and it's not like something else. Idameva satyam mogamanyam, only this is the true, everything else is stupid, then you realize, oh, okay, there's different ways of looking at things, there's different perspectives on things. Doesn't mean that there's not a truth and there's not falsehood, that's another extreme again. There is true and there is false, and we can say those things. But we say them lightly, and we say them with a sense of humility, with a sense of deference, with a sense of appreciation that we've been wrong so many times before, and we will be wrong so many times again, and with a sense of appreciation of the, you know, the power of that dark mass of ignorance, that dark mass of delusion that's always clouding our views and obscuring the truth. So the process of developing right view isn't a matter of just kind of reading a creed and saying, I'm going to believe that. Nor is it a matter of saying, oh, just whatever. It's something that's a bit more difficult than either of those paths. It's a bit more demanding. Takes a bit more effort. One thing we have to do is simply to learn. Learn from others, learn from books, learn from teachers, learn from discussing with each other. And as long as we're not enlightened, then we should take that base. Our basic attitude should be the attitude of a learner. And even if we're put in a position where we have to teach, so like for myself these days, I found myself sitting in this seat very often and talking about Dhamma a lot. And so I'm in a position of a teacher. But still, as you all know, I also spend many, many hours still learning the Dhamma. I still spend a long time still trying to learn more about the Dhamma and about the teachings and the way it's put together. I don't regard myself in any sense as being like accomplished or, you know, learned or anything like that. I'm very much a student who's trying to sort of piece together an understanding of the Dhamma and so on. And so we all need to take that kind of attitude. And this is one of the things that I've learnt through my academic work, is that come to Dhamma, things seem so clear, so black and white, so clean, and we insist on that. And if you'd listened to me 10 years ago, then I would have been much more sure that I knew what was right and what was wrong, what's Dhamma and what's not Dhamma. And I would have been very insistent on many points of Dhamma and so on, that it must be like this and it's not like the other way. And in a sense, I think that's okay. I think that in a learning process that we need to set up structures first. We need to set up clear boundaries. There needs to be a period where we, isolate, distinguish between what's Buddha Dhamma and what's not Buddha Dhamma. Between where we distinguish between, different kinds of views and truths and clarify our philosophical and so on understanding of the teachings and get our ideas straight. And so at that period we need to be drawing boundaries, we need to be making clear demarcations. But then of course if we stop at that level that becomes quite immature. And then those boundaries which have their use, then they become rigid, they become like a wall which you can't go beyond. And so this is a process that I've observed in myself over the last 10 years or so. I suppose it's really happened mostly since I started writing my first book, because that was when I really had to start looking at my understanding of Dhamma in much more carefully. It's much more difficult to get away with stuff once you put it down in print. So I had to be much more precise and careful. And I've noticed that as that process has gone on and on, then the more and more I go, then the less I think I know. And the more limited or careful I am in what I think I know and what I'm prepared to say. And so in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Buddha sets down these core teachings, sets down this pattern. It draws this pattern on the ground for the Dhamma. And the one I've been talking about mostly so far is the right view. This is like the first thing that he mentions. Interestingly enough, in this particular sutta, he doesn't go on to define or talk about the other aspects of the Noble Eightfold Path. Perhaps he assumed that his people who were listening to him already had some idea of what those were. And the main one he really needed to explain was the right view, which of course he explained as the Four Noble Truths. So this, I guess, would be one definition or one description of this process of developing right view, would be like approaching these Four Noble Truths. And through reading the suttas, through memorizing the suttas, through questioning our beliefs, through speaking with other people and clarifying doubts and so on, all of these things we move towards a understanding and a realization of these Four Noble Truths. Move towards a state where, like Anya Kandanya, we can have the Virajang Vitamalang, the stainless, immaculate eye of the truth, not just a vague perception or idea about what it might be, but this like noonday sun, standing in the noonday sun, just seeing the truth unfolding itself before you. So that when one's inside these Four Noble Truths, it's like the whole world is a manifestation of these Four Noble Truths. Just like for the Vedic priests, their ritual platforms and shrines would have been a template for the cosmos, embodying the proportions, the patterns of the universe. In the same way, when we're standing inside the Four Noble Truths and seeing out from them, then this becomes the pattern for the whole world. So in this way, like the Four Noble Truths is not something which we are standing outside and operating upon. We're not, like we're doing now, when I'm talking now, I can talk around these Four Noble Truths and keep pointing to them. But I'm kind of quite deliberately just kind of skating around them. I'm not focusing on the actual truth, the teachings themselves. I'm quite deliberately just skating around and pointing back towards and hinting and trying to show different lights on different ways of seeing them. But when we actually realize the truth, then Chakkhum udapadi jnanam udapadi vidya udapadi panya udapadi aloko udapadi vision arose, knowledge arose, realization arose, wisdom arose, light arose. And so it's as if one's whole world becomes transformed, one's whole perspective. One is seeing from inside those Four Noble Truths. This is what we call a stream entry, that moment of realization of those truths. That's not just an intellectual understanding of them, not just a grasping of them by faith, but the actual embodying those truths. And so that presentation of the world that the Buddha talked about, suffering, the origin of suffering, the ending of suffering, and the path, these four things, this becomes the pattern of one's life, the pattern of one's vision, so that everything that you see becomes seen through that perspective. So that while somebody who's a stream enter or something, one of the other stages of enlightenment, they may be able to get like temporarily confused or be unclear about something regarding the Dhamma, but on reflection it would become clear to them. So for example, they might still have attachment to something. They still might get one of Natasha's delicious quiches offered in the morning and think, oh, yummy, but they would be able to reflect on it. And, oh, that's impermanent. And when they reflected like that, then they would see that, see through it, and then that would dissolve. So this is like our nature is the other way around. It's like our nature is that, you know, our nature is to get attached to it, and we have to make ourselves reflect or try to understand them, whereas for someone who's a stream enterer, then it's the other way around. It's like their nature is always to be understanding, and occasionally they might slip away from that for a little bit, but they return to that normal state of understanding and wisdom. So Four Noble Truths, of course, being a profoundly realistic assessment of the world. Not pessimistic, not saying it's all just rubbish and there's nothing useless, nothing useful and so on, nor just blindly optimistic and saying, oh well, we're all going to get saved one day, and you know, everyone's going to get enlightened sooner or later, but realistic, saying, well, this is how it is. And so it's the very opposite of using a spin. And of course the Buddha himself did use a spin very often. He would present Dhamma in a certain way to be attractive or appealing on a certain occasion, but in his presentation of the Four Noble Truths, it's quite naked, it's very bare. And so this is why typically the Four Noble Truths would only be presented when somebody's mind was already happy, and someone's mind was already bright, when somebody's mind was already soft, mudu, when somebody's mind was already ready to understand. And then the Buddha would reveal these Four Noble Truths, and then they would penetrate, or they would understand them very deeply. So it's important to remember this, that this work of meditation, of course, we have this pair of samatha and vipassana, the samatha, the softening, cooling, gentling of the mind, and then vipassana, the straight, direct, uncompromising vision of the truth. So these things always have to come in pairs. If they don't come in a pair, then our practice will be unbalanced and we'll start to drift. So this is my talk for this evening on the Dhammacakka Sutta and the Four Noble Truths. I offer that to you for your reflection and encouragement. And I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions on the talk this evening. Yeah, don't worry, it's too dark, no one can see who's talking anyway. I only think of three of them. Suffering? You know that one? That's good. Craving. You know that one? No craving, okay. The ending of suffering. Yeah? Do you know that one? Careful now. Ending of suffering. And the last one, of course, the path. Yeah? I saw once there was a book on the great thoughts of mankind or something like that, one of these big Oxford compendiums, and I looked up the Buddha in there, and it had the Buddha's great thoughts were there is suffering and there is an origin of suffering. I thought, mediocre thoughts of mankind. So it's like that symmetry. Yeah, the origin of suffering, the ending of suffering, and the path. Which one did you forget?
The cause.
That's a very interesting question. And the Buddha explained the third noble truth, Nibbana, is the truth of cessation. And he talks about the ending of craving. Craving being the cause of suffering. It doesn't actually talk about the ending of the suffering itself. Yeah, not in that basic place. Yeah, plenty of other places it talks about the ending of suffering.
But actually, if you think the original one is just the 12 permutations of that.
Could have been, but in that 12 part thing it says sacchikatam. It says sacchikatam. I've seen with my own eyes. My brain's a little bit slow at the moment. In teaching of the Four Noble Truths, in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the explanation that's given of the third noble truth is the ending of craving. But in other places it doesn't talk about the ending of craving, but about the ending of suffering. I mean, the basic point here is that the craving is the cause. So by ending the cause, then the suffering will inevitably pass away eventually. Just like if you, hasn't necessarily yet, just like if you starve a weed, it doesn't get any water, then it's inevitably it's going to die, but it hasn't yet died. So why does the Buddha actually talk about the ending of craving rather than the ending of suffering itself? And Venerable's wondering whether there could be different definitions of that. As far as I'm aware, it's always the same in that kind of place. I think because it's more immediate, isn't it? It's more immediate, and perhaps because the Buddha's talking about his own experience, like he's completely ended. He's seen the ending of the cause of suffering, the ending of craving in himself, but he hasn't completely seen the ending of suffering. He still gets diarrhea. Still has to put up with the group of six monks in Tulananda. I don't know.
What about Asturna to the Buddha's enlightenment when he first did?
What did he say?
Do you pay originally
ordinary verse. And what did the verse say? Yeah, seeing the causes of things, the ending of causes. Suryova obhasana, suryova obhasayam antalikanti, like the sun, he lights up the sky. Yeah, in that case it's more comprehensive, it's not just the ending of craving, but the ending of everything. Hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think generally they're treated very closely, like the cause of something. It's actually quite ambiguous, like the cause of something and the origination of something. You know, they're treated. It's actually two different things, really. But like you could use samudaya for those things, like the fact that something's originated. Actually, the birth of something is different from the cause of that birth, but it's often treated it's very close. And same with the ending of it, the cutting off of the cause, and the actual ending of the thing itself also is treated almost synonymous. They're so close. Sure, yeah. I mean, I'm sure that's probably the main reason, yeah, why he talks about it in that way. Yeah. Yeah, sure. For sure. Yeah. Might not, but it probably could. I think it would probably depend on the individual. Some people, like I was saying, like some people, you know, you need to go through that sort of faith building stage of actually just, you know, not inquiring too closely into it. I mean, it's difficult for me because I'm kind of, you know, when I was a young monk, I was a young monk, and there wasn't any really teaching or encouragement to read the suttas, so I just did it by myself. And that time it was like a tremendous faith-based thing. I just used to learn suttas and recite them, and it's just wonderful. So, you know, that's a good thing to do when you need to build that up. But for me, that's I sort of take that for granted so much. And I'm quite happy to inquire and criticize and things, but maybe not best for introduction. Yeah. It's a bit of a dilemma because you also have to talk about what's interesting to yourself.
About much more practical.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, because when Philip and I was talking about development of samadhi to most people, mostly it's not really where they're at. It's very interesting and true.
Yeah.
It's mostly what he's interested in, because that's what he's to the Buddha's demonstration of how to get up in the morning is incredible. He's about 70 or past 70, and one time he demonstrated the proper way to get up in the morning, and he went from lying to standing in one movement without, I don't know how he did it, but it looked like he didn't move his arms. He just went
Wow. That's pretty cool.
It's so hard.
I was wondering, did the Buddha ever speak about why there was craving in the first place, or did he ever speak of an origin of craving?
An origin of craving? Well, he didn't like to talk about like first origins of things. So you have this kind of philosophical problem in theistic religions where they talk about the prime mover. It's originally, I think, Aristotle had this idea that you have to have a first cause that actually was lying behind everything. So that Buddhism denies that there's a first cause, or at least denies that a first cause would be knowable or useful. So the origin of craving could be understood in a couple of different ways. On a immediate level, moment-to-moment level, cravings originated by feeling. Yeah? So you experience some kind of feeling and then have a craving for it. On a deeper level, cravings conditioned by ignorance. So like ignorance is more, in a sense, more fundamental. Craving is more like the way that ignorance manifests itself. But then these things are all part of a cycle, so that whole cycle feeds on itself and stops us from seeing properly. And the very fact that we act according to the craving is what creates the conditions for more craving in the future. And so this is why that cycle is so hard to break. We'll talk more about this. We've been doing some talks on dependent origination, and we kind of got interrupted for the last few weeks, but I intend to keep going on that for the next little while. So we'll be talking more about these things. Okay, let's finish by paying respects.